You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. The communities we're part of in our youth often have a tremendous impact on influencing the people we become. For some people, it's a sports team. For others, it's a club or an after-school program. For writer James Baldwin, the time he spent in the Black Church as he grew up in Harlem played a big role in shaping his identity and the work he would go on to produce as an adult. That influence led Baldwin to write the play The Amen Corner back in 1954. And for the first time, the show is being professionally staged here in Seattle. And joining me to talk about the play and the groundbreaking theater company behind it is KUOW Arts and Culture reporter Mike Davis. Hey, Mike, you staying warm out there? It's a cold one.
You know, this is my favorite season of the year. So no, I am not staying, but I love it. I love it. I love being cold. I'm here
warm,
for it.
But you love it. I like it. You came in with a stocking cap and I was jealous because I'm freezing.
Well, I'm cozy.
You're cozy. It's cozy season. Well, today we're talking about a new production of James Baldwin's play, The Amen Corner. And the show has never had a professional production in Seattle until now. You got to go see it at the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute, which is a historic community arts center in the Central District. What is The Amen Corner about?
Well, the play was written by James Baldwin in 1954. It's actually the first stage play that he wrote. And, you know, the play, it takes place in a Black church. And I mean, there's all these themes of love, loss, death, religion, understanding. There's a coming of age story wrapped up in there, too. A brilliant, strong female lead. But what I would highlight is the joy, laughing in the face of pain. There were so many parts of this play that were laugh out loud funny. So even with all the heavy stuff, I would say the play does a great job of highlighting Black joy.
Was the crowd into it that you saw it with?
Absolutely. I actually got to go on opening night. And yeah, like we had those moments. And that's the thing about theater that I love. You know, you can sit in a dark theater and watch a movie. You can stream stuff at your house. But there's nothing like being live and having those reactions when you're laughing and everybody's laughing and you experience that together.
Live theater. There's nothing like it. What else did you talk to Reggie about?
After the show, Reggie and I talked about the play and its relevance to audiences today, but we also talked about the theater company behind the Amen Corner, the Williams Project. And they're a South Seattle-based theater ensemble, and they're trying to do something groundbreaking for the arts. They ensure all creatives who work on their shows are paid living wages, and that's everybody, actors, stage managers, set designers, everyone. And it's part of their overall mission to make theater and the arts more accessible to everyone. So I started this conversation with Reggie by asking him about his connection to the Williams Project and about the work of James Baldwin.
Very cool. Let's listen to that conversation now. Mike Davis is KUOW's arts and culture reporter. Thanks again for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
The play is about a community of people who have forgotten what it means to be human, that they get so wrapped up in what it means to be right and what that means to different people in different communities at different moments of their lives with different experiences, that they forget what it means to be human. And I had the really rich fortune of getting the opportunity to spend a lot of time with Jimmy's writing over the last couple of years. I worked on a project in New York that was basically like based on his conversation with Nikki Giovanni. And I've spent some time with his other interviews and other of his writings. And it's like, if you really look at his body of work, he was really writing about the importance of humans never forgetting that our primary responsibility to each other and to ourselves is to love and to allow ourselves to be loved. And you know, I look around at the world that we live in today, and it's frightening that his play that he wrote 70 years ago is just as urgent and necessary as it was back then. And, you know, like, especially like looking at our very, very dangerous political climate with people making all kinds of decisions that are just so puzzling how people make the decisions that they make, or make the decision to not participate in the electoral process at all, which is also a puzzling decision, especially when you know what our elders and our ancestors had to go through to get these rights in the first place. You know, yeah, it felt like it was a timely play, and I'm happy that we finally got the opportunity to do it, and like, what a rich privilege to be able to do it at Langston. Yeah, I'm very, very fortunate. I feel really fortunate to be able to be working on this play in this community at this theater in this moment.
Opening night was amazing, and it was a privilege for me to get to be there. And because I had that experience, I gotta say, the way that you just talked about the play, yes, it's very true. It's very timely. It's election season. We're seeing what it means to be right in all of this humanity. But I'm gonna tell you one thing that jumped out to me when I was in that theater, and that was the comedy. It was funny. Like, I laughed. So, like, yes, we're hitting on all of these topics. We're gonna talk about that brilliant black woman who is such a strong lead. We could get into that, but people need to know that this is a good time.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that. I think black people know this obviously because we live it every single day, but to live in this raggedy society, you gotta have our sense of humor is elite. For us to have gone through 300 years of being sold like objects, and then another 150 years of them being like, you have rights, but not those. Oh, you could, no, but no, you gotta, no, you gotta, you can't sit at the, you had to sit at the back. No, you can't buy a house. No, you can't go to college. No, you can't do this. No, you can't, but no, you're still human, but we want you to vote for us. Like, our sense of humor is like, they should study it for the rest of civilization because, we're incredible. Like, black people are so amazing. And, I mean, me, myself, as a black queer man growing up in a homophobic white supremacist society, my sense of humor is elite. And I think it was really important for me too, just as a theater maker, I'm not interested in plays about blackness or black people that are just like parades of trauma because that's not real life. Like, even people of profound difficulty find moments to laugh, find moments of levity, find moments of joy. And yeah, I think also too, the nine humans in that play are so full of light and warmth and joy and delight that it was like, I want you all to be able to bring the fullness and the richness of how you show up as humans to this play. The actor who plays Brother Boxer, he's a clown. Like, yes, he is a very talented actor who has studied at the best acting schools in the country, but that man is a clown. He is a full-on clown. And so I was like, yes, please bring it to the stage. The woman who plays Sister Boxer, the crazy thing about Felicia is she's so funny and she's not even trying. She just walks up and is like, hey, how you doing? And everybody's just like in stitches. I feel like, they did my job for me. But yeah, there's, it's a tough play and it's hard and there's lots of emotions and there's plenty of sad stuff that happens, but it's funny.
That's the realness that you're hitting on, because there's a lot of things that have to be processed, a lot of family structures, a lot of love, loss of life, like all of these types of things play out, but you're still able to laugh and enjoy it. And that was big. And the way that y'all captured the way that church folks talk to each other was also masterful. Because any of us that grew up in the church, we know they can say the most disrespectful, smile on their face, put it in the, you know what I'm saying? And it was just great how y'all captured that.
My favorite line, or one of my favorite lines, Felicia, who plays Sister Boxer, truly, when we were doing our meet and greet during tech, and everyone was going around and saying who they were, and I was like, I'm Reggie, and I'm the Sister Boxer understudy, because she has some of the best lines. Like when she spends that whole scene talking about how her husband is like dying in his sins and rotten away, then she's like, I have yet to say my first word against your sister, and we're like, what are you talking about? And that's the thing is I didn't change any of the language. Like Jimmy wrote that 70 years ago, which also too is why I was like, this play is so current because people still talk like this. Nothing has changed about the way that we talk to each other, the way we talk about each other, the way that we think about each other. So yeah, no, I when we were in rehearsal, I was just like, this man is so brilliant because he wrote that 70 years ago, and it feels like the way we talk now.
Yes, no, I love that. I love that. And one thing too that I always appreciate
in theater. I mean, you know, we got movies and all this technology these days, but you can't replicate the experience of being in that live crowd. So when you're talking about the line that you just mentioned, all of us in the crowd were like, what? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all experienced that and we all had that moment together. Tell us a little bit about the Williams Project. Tell us about living wage theater and what it means for the actors.
You know, I've been doing this professionally for, Lord, over a decade, which is crazy. And there have been some improvements in our industry, you know, in the ways in which we think about how actors get compensated. And it is a little bit of a perception problem because, like, on one end of the spectrum, you have all of these, like, Variety reports and Hollywood Reporter reports about how, like, you know, Julia Roberts and Jennifer Lawrence and other white actors are making like tens of million dollars to be in a movie. And even like Viola Davis, who is like one of the greatest living actors of our generation, is like, I don't make as much money as them, but still, like, Viola Davis can get guacamole at Chipotle whenever she wants to. You know what I mean? Like, she could buy a couple Chipotles if she wanted to. So there's that one end of the spectrum of like movie stars and people who are like ultra successful. And then you have people who work in theater who are working just as hard. Like, I remember one of my like first acting jobs, I was working on a play for 3 months and I got $150 to be in a Shakespeare play. And I had a lot of lines and I had to go to a lot of rehearsals and I had to do that play a lot of times. And, you know, like, I think people are like, oh, well, it's your passion. You don't need to get paid. And it's like, you mind telling T-Mobile? You mind telling my landlord? You mind telling Visa and American Express and everybody else that, like, I'm getting paid in experience and passion? Like, nah, baby, I need coins. And so what I love about Williams Project making that like a part of their mission is that their mission is, they say, they pay artists a living wage, because I think a lot of how people think about compensation in the performing arts begins and ends with the actor, but it doesn't take into account the designers. It doesn't take into account the backstage technical people. It doesn't take into account the stage managers. And so, like, what I love about Williams Project is they're saying that even the unglamorous positions still deserve to earn a living wage for the work that they do, because it's all important. And I love that. I love that. I'm so happy to be a part of this company, because, you know, like, it's easy to release a statement every 5 years when something bad goes on, or people, you know, everybody had them damn black squares last summer. But, like, did your mission statement change? Did your budget change? You know, like, are the plays that you're programming changing? And I am so excited that, like, you know, there are no brownie points for being right before, but, like, the Williams Project has been on the correct side of this issue, particularly as it relates to pay equity in our industry, for a long time. And it's so great to be associated with a company of people who are like committed to leading by example, which I really love.
Is this something that is special and unique to the Williams Project, or is this something that you're seeing throughout the industry?
No, sadly. This is a Williams Project. This is a thing where Williams Project is leading the country, essentially. And, you know, Ryan and I have had lots of conversations, and I think this just isn't a conversation that we're having. And also, too, because theater is broken up into a bunch of different unions. There's like the directors union for it's SDC, so it's stage directors and choreographers. There's the musicians union. There's the backstage union. There's the actor and stage manager union. There's the designer union. And so everyone is like taking care of themselves, and the producers are like, well, we're just doing our best, like, we don't know, whatever. And Williams Project is saying, like, from the jump, we just want everybody to know, when you come to the table, we're not trying to take advantage of anybody. Like, everybody is getting paid a living wage salary. And yeah, I think more people should be thinking about it that way, because it also takes into account that, like, what living wage means is different depending on the place that you live. You know what I mean? Like, Seattle is a very expensive city to live in. So, you know, for an actor working somewhere else that is a cheaper cost of living, you might look at that salary of what they pay, and they're like, oh, this is fantastic, or this is not enough. Like, and I think it requires a real rigor and imagination about what the economics of being a working artist mean. And I just, again, like, I'm so honored to be arm in arm with Ellen and Ryan and Deidre and the rest of the board, because like, they've done the work, and it's not easy work to do, especially when you're starting a theater company from scratch. Like, the Williams Project isn't even 10 years old. And to have that kind of commitment to literally put your money where your mouth is in so many situations or circumstances where it's like, oh, well, we want to pay a living wage, but let's just not say that, and we'll call it something else because it's too expensive to do this. Like, they've raised the money, they've done the research, they do the work, they continue to push their budget, they continue to fundraise, they continue to you know, like, make really smart artistic choices, and it takes a lot of work. And I hope the rest of the country hears about the work the Williams Project is doing and feels called to, like, to name that as a value, as opposed to just saying, like, we just want to do good plays and, you know, shrug our arms at the economics of it all. Because you realize that when you don't take into account the economics of what it means to be a working artist, that's a huge barrier to entry to people without tons of financial security or safety nets, cough, 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 namely people of color, namely people that don't come from wealthy backgrounds. And so you are creating a sort of like faux bourgeoisie when art should be for and by everybody. And I love that the Williams Project is like, this is going to take us some sleeve rolling up. We're going to have to actually commit to some like market research. We got to do some economics. We got to do some fundraising. It's not just about doing the pretty plays that everybody wants to see. It's lots of, you know, back end behind the scenes work to make sure that like they are fulfilling their commitment to make sure that every artist who works at the Williams Project can afford to live.
But it's possible because y'all is doing it.
We've been doing it.
It can be done. Now, I want to ask this question too, because the A-Man Corner was at Langston, and you mentioned before being at Washington Hall. Are you guys picking these venues specifically, or is this random?
Not random. Nah, it ain't random. So what I love about the way that we've gone about producing, at least the last 5 years that I've been associated with it, is like, there's a real question about where's the best space to tell this story. So when I did Blues for Mr. Charlie, we did it at Emerald City Bible Fellowship, because a lot of that play takes place in a church. We did Blood Wedding, and it was like, it really felt like an event that needed some sort of like not multidisciplinary, but like it didn't feel like it belonged in a theater. So we did it at Equinox down south, basically like under the airport, because there were airplanes flying over us every 34 seconds. And when we did the bar plays, like, we wanted to make a bar out of the stage, and we wanted to like make the audience feel like they were in a bar. And not only is the Central District a great place to make theater, because you also, like, part of inviting historically underinvited communities to participate in theater is like not telling them to go downtown, but doing the work where they live, which is, again, not a step that lots of people are willing to make because it pushes them out of their comfort zone. And there were a couple different options. And when Ryan told me that Langston's like mission, it's even part of their tagline, is like cultivating Black brilliance, I was like, stop, no, I don't care where else it is. If it's at Bill Gates' front lawn, I don't care. We doing this play at Langston because Black brilliance is Jimmy. Black brilliance is Langston. You know, I aspire to honor their brilliance through my work. So I was like, no, it has to be here. It can't be anywhere else.
We love South Seattle around here. Now, can you tell me a little bit about the process that you took to transform Langston into the church that I stepped into last week?
I have to give so much credit to the building itself. You know what I mean? Like, I think what Tim and Jasmine have done with that space in making it a space that is so welcoming to theater is like such a gift. We didn't really need to do much to make it absolutely perfect. I remember when I came in and I did a site visit in April, and I was like, oh, this is perfect. And I knew that I wanted to like do some, I wanted to make some directorial choices that made the audience feel like they were in the church. You know, like, I'm not gonna spoil nothing, but you know, because you sat where you sat and I saw you, that like things was happening. And so I was like, oh great, it feels really exciting that we don't have to change the space in any way, because like sometimes that can be really expensive, it can be very time consuming, whatever. But like the space was perfectly ready for us to do the show that I hoped we could do. And then I had the outrageous fortune of having Anlyn Dauber, our genius scenic and costume designer, come up with an incredible scenic design. And like, she's so smart. There are like layers on layers on layers in the design. Like the actual like set is built like a cross. The church bisects the apartment. There's like all kinds of like beautiful metaphors. There's like the rich red. There's all that stuff. And then we talked, when we were talking about like, did I want to set the play in 1953 when he wrote it, or did I want to make the play contemporary? Because like my feeling about it is like, if a playwright writes a contemporary play in a time, unless there is a specific historical event that they're linking it to, I feel like the spirit of that play is meant to be contemporary. So like, yes, there are some anachronistic record, like references to like a phonograph or whatever, but I was like, no, the play is a contemporary play. However, what I wanted to do, because I feel like the legacy of Black artists is that we're always standing on the shoulders of those who came before us. So there's this beautiful like clapboard artwork she did, where like on the bottom perimeter of the two platforms and that big wall behind the pulpit are these like beautiful collages of historical Black moments, because like we are our past, we are our present, and we are our future. You know, it's so insane to think that we're not even like three generations away from touching when we were enslaved in this country, and to look at how far we've come while still being so close to a period in time where the people who were our neighbors thought about us as property. Like, we are still living in that legacy. And so I wanted the set to have some sort of representation, like to be in relationship to our past. And I thought the way that she executed it was so beautiful and also so subtle. Like you walk in the space and you see it and you're like, oh, that's pretty. And then like, hopefully during intermission or before the show starts, you like look at it and you're like, oh, I know that image, or I know that image, or those are the four girls, or those are the I am a man protest, or that's this, or that's that. And like, what I love is that this play in this place with these people is such a conversation about what it means to be Black in this country, and that it's an ongoing conversation, but it's also a conversation that's been started centuries ago, and that we're just continuing the work that's been done before us. And so I the set is gorgeous. Like, I remember when it finally came together, like I gasped, because like it couldn't be more perfect.
Thank you so much for that, Reggie. And before I let you go, can you just give our audiences one thing, without spoilers, just one thing that they'll be able to take away if they come see the Amen Corner at Langston?
I think the thing I hope people will be able to take away if they see Amen Corner at Langston until November 20th, running Wednesday through Sunday, is that at the end of the day, the most important, I couldn't sum this up without quoting the man himself, James Baldwin, is that the most important thing a man can have, and meaning like a human can have, is themselves, is your relationship with yourself. Are you being honest with yourself? Are you taking care of yourself? Are you listening to yourself? Are you creating boundaries for yourself? Are you making electoral choices that support yourself? Are you in community with people who honor yourself? And also that it's never too late to make a different decision. You know what I mean? That we see a couple people in the play make choices that seem difficult, but they're choosing themselves. And I think it's a constant reminder that like, we got to take care of ourselves.
That is Reggie D. White, director of the Amen Corner, playing at Langston until when, Reggie?
November 20th.
There we go. Reggie, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to KUOW Arts and Culture reporter Mike Davis for bringing us that interview. Ticket information for the Amen Corner can be found at langstonseattle.org or thewilliamsproject.org. And we'll have a link to that info on our website, kuow.org. Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime right here online at kuow.org, or of course on your favorite podcast app.